This episode is brought to you by Hill's Pet Nutrition. Every shelter pet deserves a second chance, and you're making it possible for thousands of them every day. Because when you feed your pet Hill's, you help feed a shelter pet, which helps make them healthy, happy, and more adoptable, changing their life forever. So they can change yours. Over 14 million shelter pets fed and adopted. Science did that. Visit hillspet.com/podcast to learn more.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Beyond, and hello everyone, my name is Jonathan Dornbush, and this is Podcast Beyond, IGN's weekly PlayStation show, where we occasionally talk about PlayStation. Today we're going to talk a lot about it. This is episode 608. I am joined this week by Brian Altano.
Hi, Beyond.
Lucy O'Brien.
Beyond.
And Max Scoville.
And a Beyond to you, good sir.
Beyond to you as well. Thank you all so much for listening or watching this episode. Today is going to be a Last of Us Part 2 bonanza, because I played 2.5 hours of that game. It's a real game. I've played it. It was a little weird that that game exists, and I actually got to play it. We have a release date thanks to the State of Play trailer. It is coming out February 21st, 2020. I am free to talk about everything I played at that event, and we'll talk a little bit about the State of Play as a whole as a wrap-up to this conversation. But wanted to open up the floodgates to talk about what I played. So basically, whatever questions you guys have for me, I will answer about what I played. I can give a brief rundown of what I saw, and we can jump from there.
Sure. Set the mood a little bit about what the event was like, and which dilapidated coffee shop you got to pretend you were in.
We were brought to the Hollywood Modern Warehouse, a big, big open space with like 12 TVs in it.
Okay.
And so we were brought in. We had a brief presentation about the game, with some helpful gameplay tips from game wiki expert Neil Druckmann. And he gave us some advice on what we were about to play. And then we sat down. There were a few stands. You may have seen photos online on my Twitter or other people's who attended. They had just like a rundown shack over here or a Rustin's Coffee over there. Nothing that extravagant. It was actually pretty low-key as an event. But they had a few of those stands and then just a bunch of TVs, and they said, sit down, play The Last of Us Part 2. And what we played was two levels. I think both were pretty early in the game. They didn't tell us exactly specifics, but they were not the intro to the game. They were a level called Patrol, and then there was a level called Suburbs. Patrol was set in Jackson, Wyoming, where Ellie and Joel are living post The Last of Us 1. They're living there. This sequence took place immediately after the E3 2018 trailer, where we saw Ellie at that dance with Dina, played by Shannon Woodward, and the two of them kiss at that dance. And then we see a next day, which is basically a patrol, a day in their life of how they live at this encampment. The second part was Suburbs, which was set in Seattle. And Seattle has basically been turned into this militant overrun state by a group called the WLF. And basically, if you are not a member of the WLF or part of their regime, the people that they look over, they don't want you in Seattle. And they will either take you prisoner or kill you as a result. And Ellie is there to rescue some friend who shouldn't be there. And that leads to a lot of terrible, terrible interactions with terrible scavengers.
Now, but you have an idea of where these are set sort of in the story following the trailer, but do you have a sense of how they are in the structure of the game?
I think they were both Act 1, for sure. I would say, so there will be some story spoilers throughout what we talk about. I'll try to keep it as light as possible, but the second chapter, the Suburbs bit, they were definitely split apart. They did not happen sequentially. Suburbs ended with that moment with Joel at the end of the new release date trailer, where he's there and keeps her safe from scavengers and then is like, why? What do you think? I'd let you do this alone. That's how that demo ended. And I think that's a hell of an Act 1 to me. Like, that felt like a great Act 1. Here's the end of the story. Okay, we're going to get into something totally different now. Because to me, that implies Joel is not really a big presence in the first sort of third of the game, at least.
And I love how the tables will be turned, possibly in the second act, where Joel is your companion.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
And we still have this, obviously, the lingering bombshell from the end of the first game. And does that feel like there's animosity there? Does that feel like that will get addressed?
It definitely does. And I got to speak to Neil Druckmann after as well. And the way he described it was like, in this game, their relationship is strained. Mm-hmm. Like, they still love each other, but the events of the first game definitely impacted them. And, you know, the end of The Last of Us leaves some room open to interpretation of how Ellie took what happened and how much she actually knows. I think Ellie is a smart enough person to know what transpired.
Yeah.
But
she would have figured it out by now.
Exactly. Yeah. And especially by now, I think she knows.
Yeah, it's tough to... We will try our best to not spoil that game because it is a PlayStation Plus game.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, presumably if you're watching stuff about The Last of Us Part 2, you played The Last of Us Part 1. And if you haven't, it's on PlayStation Plus.
Well, just look, but suffice to say the ending of The Last of Us original was very... It left Joel in a very morally gray area.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. It is, like, I would say, one of the best video game endings.
I think, yeah, but sure. In a AAA game, for me, the best. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That and probably Super Mario Brothers 2, where it's streaming.
Fair. Yeah.
Which is very special.
And Conker's Bad Fur Day.
Yeah, that was...
This actually has a lot of parallels with Conker's Bad Fur Day, but we'll get to that
I want that Obed. I want that Obed.
So... Yeah, it very much felt like these two chapters were in the pretty early on in the game. Mm-hmm. The first patrol level very much felt like here's how some of the new mechanics work. Here's like the basics of combat. So that I would say is probably within the first hour or two after whatever the intro is. And then patrol is probably a little bit later on from there. But Neil and then some of the other team members, like they were very much reiterating at this event, what you're seeing is a very small slice of this game. Like they've been saying this is the biggest game Naughty Dog has ever done in terms of scope on a gameplay complexity level, on a world level, on a story level.
I'm a little, I don't want to say like skeptical about, I am a little apprehensive about, because I did feel like Uncharted 4, while it had a ton of excellent stuff, did have a little bit of bloat and overstayed its welcome a little bit. I did appreciate that it allowed you and the story to sort of stop and smell the roses here and there, but that game felt needlessly padded at times with a lot of like great puzzle stuff.
Yeah.
But that said, this has always been a more story-driven, you know, output from that studio, and so I do have faith that something cool will come from all that. I mean, like my favorite seasons of TV shows are 8 to 10 hours, you know. I would say that my least favorite shows are the ones that are 24 hours a season. And so I do hope that there is a narrative justification for this being that long. I know gamers do tend to conflate longer with better because it is a better value for $60. But at the end of the day, I want them to have like a very strong narrative-driven reason to be here for this long. And I think
they
will.
I would say that the tone of The Last of Us is definitely more suited to a longer game. Mm-hmm. It does have those sort of quiet moments. It's a sort of stealth game, which encourages you to sort of, like, it's kind of, it's brooding, and it's tonally much different from Uncharted, which is, you don't see many, like, you know, popcorn action movies that are 4 hours long, whereas, you know, dramatic prestige television goes on for, you know,
seasons.
Plenty of time. Yeah.
And even just from a gameplay perspective, you touched on it, Max, like, we were just chatting before, The Last of Us is very much it has a beating heart of a survival horror, which means that, you know, instead of plowing through wave after wave of enemies like you do in Uncharted 4, which did grow tiresome by the end, you know, like theoretically every encounter will be very considered.
Yeah, like each combat encounter I had, and we can get into combat in a second, is very like brutal, and I had to consider every single opponent that I could run into. But yeah, in terms of game length side, I am definitely cautiously optimistic, because right now we can only go on the faith of what we've been told. But talking to Neil, he very much said like the thing that's core to the team about The Last of Us is its tension, and that never lets up. You do have those quiet moments here and there, but like as an overarching story, it is constantly propelling you forward. Mm-hmm. And he said that was the goal with this game. Like, this is not a game where they're padding it out with like, here's 20 fun side missions right now. Like, he was like, this is a tense game all the way through, and we're keeping that tone and that pace in the sequel. It just happens to be larger. That's because awesome. The story necessitated that.
Right.
It's like Dean is missing and she's got to go collect 10 flowers first.
Yeah.
You know? Sorry, guys, just going to go do this.
Yeah. No. He even said that as an example. He's like, there's nothing worse in a game where you're like, hey, I need to save my best friend, but first, let me find these 5 potions for you. Yeah.
I'm going to go out on patrol, look for survivors, but also collect 100 crickets because I want to impress a girl.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that was basically me and Horizon. I was like, there's a lot to do, but I should get the coffee mugs. Because I'm a sucker for stuff like that. The environments, speaking of which, did they feel like there was a little more room to swim around, or not necessarily swim around because Ellie couldn't swim in the first game?
And I saw no swimming here. I saw no swimming. So okay. swimming TBD. I forgot to ask Neil about swimming.
I've said this before. She has nothing to do and she has no school.
She should learn to swim.
Learn to swim.
It's not a bad idea.
Sort it out.
Yeah, environmentally, it's... So the approach that they're taking is that, like, wide linear thing that everyone likes to say and is such a marketing term. But essentially, like, it is a game that has forward momentum both on the story and your progression of the world. But you'll get to areas that are larger. And
so kind of like, you know, like God of War, Tomb Raider, which I was thinking earlier, we don't actually have a term for that.
You just said wide linear,
which is what they call it on the dev side.
Because they hate, this is the thing, devs, when you talk to devs, because everyone's always angling for, is it open world? Is it open world? Mm-hmm. And they're like, no, it's not open world, but then they have nothing to kind of replace it with.
Yeah.
You can't say open-ish.
Yeah, open-ish. I think wide linear is probably, I mean, I hate it, but it's probably the best description we've got so far.
I understand it.
Yeah.
I would say the structure of the first Last of Us is very much rooted in last gen. Like, it we got this... You know, PS4 and this generation has brought a ton of open world is almost standard, and that level of sort of openness and sort of player freedom. And we saw this with Uncharted 4, where there's the big whole like Jeep area and, you know, big sort of sprawling areas to explore. But it's still a linear story. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We almost have to kind of rewind and be like, talk about how it's structured.
Yeah.
But can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So at least in the portions that I saw, it was very much like as you progressed through that level, there are certain points where it closes off the back part of that level. Like, you're progressing through a story beat in mm-hmm. this world. And so if you missed, you know, a couple pieces of ammo back there or some medication to help like up your skills, it's gone. But there were, you could stop and you could explore these full areas. So the best example is in suburbs. Usually each encounter area would be a stretch of street that had probably 5 to 6 different buildings there and, you know, pathways around the backs and hidden compartments and like maybe a building off to the side that I didn't know. You could just run straight through to the one building that you need to get to the back door of and go up a ladder. Mm-hmm. But you can also stop and explore all these areas. And what's different about Ellie versus Joel is Ellie can jump in this game. She has a dedicated jump button. And so, you know, second stories of buildings are more easily accessible. Right. If you can jump on the hood of a car and then get to an awning, you can get to the second story of a building.
So there's a bit more verticality.
Yeah, there's a bit more verticality and openness to it.
I think what's awesome about that storytelling for this franchise specifically is that it lends itself better to the sort of like ancillary narrative elements that you find digging through somebody's abandoned bedroom rather than something like Uncharted, which is like, you give me a wide linear area and there's mostly going to be trees and some rivers, maybe a cool snake. I do love a good snake. But in a game like this, like, you can go into a house and be like, oh, there was a tragedy here. Like, what is the story? Let's go in this kid's room and see what their posters were like. How did their parents live? Like, what did their last meal look like? Oh, it's sitting on the table. There's a lot of that I love.
I love that kind of stuff. And also the commentary around that from the characters as well.
Well, what's interesting about this one, too, is especially in the suburbs area, there was essentially a, like, sub-story that I could find through a series of notes left in houses back and forth to a couple people who were trying to outrun the WLF and save their families. I don't want to spoil it too much because it's an interesting story in there. But it was one of those things where you'd go into a back room and you find it. Ellie's alone, so in that section, you just have to take from it what you do. But I knew that, oh, okay, I found this first note. There's probably going to be one up ahead. I want to search each building because I want to know what happened to these people. Mm-hmm. And it's definitely a storytelling device they used in the first game. But because of how wide the world is, you do get a lot more of those, oh, why is the house like this? Oh, that window's broken. And then you see this trail of things going that way. They must have been attacked and ran that way or things like that.
Right.
Is crafting back? All that
crafting
stuff?
Is back, yeah. It was largely what we saw last time. So the like trap mines that you can place down, health packs, stun bombs were in there, Molotov cocktails, pretty... At least from what we saw, yeah, not too demonstrably different. There were that, and then you could pick up the pill bottles that eventually let you upgrade abilities.
How about sort of like ammo restrictions and, you know?
It's tight. Like, there's this first section, I only had, I think, maybe 2 guns. The second section, I had like 6 guns, but I only had, you know, 3 to 7 bullets per gun. And if I didn't search through that world, I was going to run out of ammo super quick. And so like when I got to the final combat encounter, I went into it. I got tripped up and got spotted by two enemies and unloaded almost all of my ammo in that time, and then had to spend the rest of the time slowly stealthing so I could get, you know, a bullet here or a bow, an arrow here, because the bow and arrow does return. It's not from the start of the game, at least. In the demo I played, she gets a bow at some point during Suburbs. But
I have a question just before, because I really want to talk to you a bit more about story. but just before then, you talked to me about earlier about how the AI in this game are like terrifyingly smart.
They're smart. Yeah.
Which I love, because, you know, it really does kind of take you out when the AI just comes up to you and you're like you're hiding in some grass and it's just like, oh, what? I don't know.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
Yeah, so the enemy AI kind of goes hand in hand with the stealth updates that they've done. So the way they're dubbing is called analog stealth. Ellie can be upright, she can crouch, and then she can lay prone. And when she's laying prone, she can, you know, shamble her way through the grass. And if it's taller grass, she's largely occluded, but you are never fully out of sight. So if someone was on a second story, they might be able to look down and see you down there. If someone is walking by you and sees a rustle, they're going to come check it out. And more so than like in an Assassin's Creed, where even if you run into enemies, they don't notice you sometimes.
Right. We saw this a bit in the E3 demo where she goes into the car.
Yeah, and so, like, they are looking for you. Like, they know to be looking for people who don't belong. And so they are smart about that. And so if they see a rustle over here, they're going to say, hey, I saw something over here. The three of you come here, but go that way first. Like, go around that house in case they try to sneak around. Like, they are smart enough to know the area. To
it gives me chills just thinking about it.
And there's bespoke dialogue for all of that.
Yeah, so all of the characters know each other by name. So a character would be like, hey, Rebecca, go left. Well, I'll take this way. And
it's like henchmen evolved.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They're really smart henchmen. And so I was in the middle of a firefight. I got spotted and I was in hand-to-hand combat with this woman. I killed her. And then a man on the bottom floor, we were on a balcony and he could see us through like the open slats in the balcony and we were standing up. He saw I killed her and he's like, Rebecca, no! That bitch killed him! Sorry for cursing. But he was like, no, we have to get her! And it was like really tense. And it was like, oh, I may have killed this man's wife.
Oh my God.
I don't know him, but you know.
I mean, I remember playing the first one and like, I've said this and people get mad at me for saying it and how it's not fun in that it makes you feel bad for stabbing someone in the neck with a shiv, which is a thing that should not be fun because it's very bad to do that.
But that's exactly, you know, for me, I've always found the violence in The Last of Us to be very, very fitting to its world. Mm-hmm. It's very brutal and it makes you feel, it's exactly as you say, Max.
No,
it makes you feel shitty. It makes you feel like you've done something awful in order to survive.
And it shakes you up.
It does.
Like
that's the point.
It feels like a very human survival horror. And
yes.
It's the part where like maybe you want to avoid combat because you're short on resources or because it's a tricky situation or it'll become more difficult if you do engage. But also, maybe you don't want to kill Rebecca in front of her husband.
Yep.
Well, and I mean, maybe you want to have like an action. Like we have an emotional connection to the characters who are the protagonists, but like to have a sort of hesitance to do anything to the antagonist is sort of like, oh, that's a total.
Because there's an inherent ambiguity to survival in that there isn't a definitive right answer for what you're supposed to do when everything goes bad.
But that's why I love this series, and it is a series now because there are two. This is why I love the series so much because it's so morally it's just ambiguous. You don't know whether you're the good guy. You don't know whether Joel's a good guy. I don't know if Ellie's like, you know, I don't know how I'm going to feel after like watching her shiv a guy in the neck over and over and over.
Well, and it's that thing of running away is a viable option. So if you get caught in combat,
can you shiv a guy in the neck or is it in the back?
I think when you trap him, you take the knife around to the front. Yeah, I think it's in the front. So anyway, you can run away. Like running away in this game is a viable option in combat, and especially if you feel bad about killing, as I did sometimes until I was like, I'm backed into a corner. These people have to die.
Right.
But because it's kill or be killed, I could run away. I could hop a fence, run around this building, sneak in the back door of it, go up to the second story, climb out a window, jump down to the grass, and then go into another building, and they have no idea where I am anymore. And then I could try to sneak through because you can stealth your way through all the combat. Mm-hmm. Like you don't have to. And I did a couple times, but I couldn't toward the end of the demo. It got real hard and I died a few times, but because of the introduction of dogs. And some of the human enemies have dogs with them, and the dogs can sniff your trail. And you can see what that trail is with the listen abilities back that Joel had. You can, you know, listen to the world and see clickers through walls and whatnot. But you can also see the scent trail that you've left behind that a dog will follow.
Now, and you can kill the dogs.
You can kill the dogs.
Speaking of moral ambiguity,
I feel like there's a lot more people who are going to have a hard time killing the dogs than killing the
people. These are regular dogs. I mean, the thing is, we've killed a lot of dogs in video games, but like often they're like mutant dogs or whatever. Like these are just like
these are
regular
dogs. Yeah. I mean, these are dogs that have been trained to kill by a terrible militia group. They're still dogs. Yeah. And I died several times in that game. In the demo, because I didn't want to kill the dogs until
they
one time.
They make a terrible sound when they. Oh no! Don't tell me. Actually,
One time I was backed into
a
corner.
They actually talk now. They go, "Oh no,
Ruh-roh." They're all voiced by Gilbert Gottfried, actually. And then I got
you stabbed me in the neck.
That would actually be fun.
Not so much Game of the Year material.
Ruh-roh.
Please mod that into a game.
I feel like you laugh at a lot of jokes from the 70s.
Oh my god, I'm putting that in my Twitter bio.
She didn't get Scooby-Doo until like 5 years ago.
No, there are like murderers on death row who have killed people who, like, when someone gets to that jail who killed a dog, they're like, let's kill that guy. We have rules to this shit.
Yeah. Well, and so when you get into those situations, it was, oh, I'm going to let myself die because I don't want to kill a dog.
Right.
Like that was how I thought. And then one time I accidentally killed a dog and was like, all right, everyone dies now. Like this is an all, everything's gone because I need to survive.
So going back to the scent thing, do you get a sense if there's anything you can do to hide that? Like if you can put on deodorant or wash or whatever?
Yeah, deodorant is a new pickup. Basically what you can do
is. Are you serious?
No, it's not. Oh, that'd be very funny.
I don't know, man. I play Metal Gear. They got all kinds of weird nonsense.
Yeah, I'd believe it. In this game, when a dog has your scent and you can see it, you can distract that dog from that trail by throwing a bottle or a brick the same way you can trick a human enemy or a clicker. And then they're off your trail. But if you're within a close enough proximity to them again, like if you just stay put, they'll eventually get back on your trail. Okay. So if you walk away, they'll lose that trail, but you may walk into the territory of another dog. Like basically think of wherever a dog is, they have a certain probably radius where they'll start to pick up your scent.
Can you throw a steak like in the cartoon?
I wish.
I'm glad you asked that because I was going to go there next.
Neil refused to answer my question about that.
I have a quick question.
Yes.
So you fought human enemies.
Yes.
You killed a couple of dogs.
Let's not talk about it.
And you killed some clickers in the first part of the game that you played.
Yes, and then there were
Part of the demo.
Yeah.
Did you encounter any new like clicker types? Because we saw some in the story trailer.
Yeah, so in the patrol portion, I was just fighting runners. So if they heard me, they'd come blaring for me if they heard or saw me. And then clickers who can only go by hearing.
Did they seem any different?
No, they seemed largely the same, I would say. Clickers, it felt like when I got into a situation where if one trapped me, I was done for, like, instantly. I felt very much defenseless almost against them. But runners, I just felt, and it's been a while since I played the first game, but I felt very much on edge around them. Like, it was very, like, if they even get the slightest hint of me, I'm done for.
Do you think they'll do clicker dogs?
I hope not.
Because that's, but I'll kill those, no problem.
I mean, yeah, it'd be better than the real dogs.
Real dogs once.
I mean, we saw like, an elk torn apart in... I don't know what the rules to this world are.
I would say that was the clickers and runners that I encountered. The implication is they attacked that deer. But it didn't turn into a clicker deer. We'll see if it does later. But they acted, I'd say, largely the same to the first game. There wasn't too much different there. But there was a new introduction of the Shambler, I believe it was called. And the Shambler, he is like all upper body mass. Like he has that weird V basically and then circles around because he's all mutated.
How gross they are. Like, they're so revolting. I just want them to get out of my face.
They're like, they're different than regular zombies in that they're like gassy and pussy.
Oh, they're so they look
there's
so
just
gassy.
Like crap shooting
like,
out of
blah.
Them.
Yeah. When you kill
California raisin.
Mm-hmm.
When you kill a Shambler, it explodes a cloud of dust.
Ugh.
Right.
Like a very pretty thick cloud
of
dust.
Oh man, that would
takes
smell
a while
so
to dissipate.
Bad.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it might not. It's spores. It could just be like a fresh mushroom.
Yeah.
Which doesn't smell great. It's earthy. You know?
That's
I think
the best
it would be like a rancid
smell.
Mushroom. Like a rancid mushroom. Like a fleshy rancid mushroom.
Right,
I think it would smell
down.
Like the band Rancid.
Stop it.
So the Shambler was meant to be a much more like brutal. I think it's like if they get to you, you're done for. Mm. Like there's very little leeway there. I was able to trick mine and never had to engage in combat with it because it was in a room with another runner. I distracted the runner, which sent the shambler after the runner, but the shambler was a little slower, obviously. So I set down a trap mine in between when they entered this room. Trap mine exploded, threw a Molotov at it, and then a couple shotgun blasts and it was down. So like if you can all out assault at them, you can kill them pretty easily, but that uses a lot
then
of your...
all your resources
Your resources are gone. Yeah. So yeah, it was that. Or my guess is I probably could have, you know, tried to pick it off, but it would have taken a lot of running around to maintain my stealth.
Mm-hmm. Can we quickly touch on like the story stuff that you saw in terms of the relationship between Ellie and Dina, which was the main kind of... relationship that you saw in this demo, right?
Yeah.
Like
yeah.
You saw Joel at the very end, but
yeah.
You didn't get much of him.
No.
Definitely one they've been focusing on since last year at E3 too.
Yeah. So some story spoilers follow. But basically, the first level of the game that I played, Patrol, was very much more akin to a classic Last of Us setup. It was Ellie and an AI companion. So Dina is with you that whole time. She can, you know, help out in combat and things. She's never obtrusive or gets in the way, but she's with you the whole time. The level is really about what a day in their life is like, but this level takes place immediately after that kiss. So obviously there's a bit of an unspoken, hey, where do things stand? And the level, you know, they get into some tense encounters and some tense moments, but the whole level is kind of them trying to figure out where the other stands right now. And so the dialogue is, you know, it's a bleak, snowy day, but it's funny and it's pithy. And there's this unspoken, wonderful chemistry between the two of them. Like all throughout this level, Shannon Woodward as Dina and Ashley Johnson as Ellie are so together. And just the way they play off each other is so natural. And just instantly I was like, oh, I love this relationship. I believe in these two as people who love each other as friends and maybe something more. Like I see that right from the jump. And so you get this back and forth. They're, you know, mocking each other here and there cutely and whatnot. And then they get to a moment where they're at a watchtower where they check in about their patrol so far. And they're both standing at the balcony of the second level, looking out over the snowy hills. They can see a town where they have to go. They're just looking out. They're enjoying the day. And they're just having this peaceful moment. They trade some light banter back and forth. And then Dina walks away and Ellie is just standing there. And the game is still running. And it's quiet. And I don't do anything for a second because I'm like, okay, when does something happen? And I was like, oh no, I have to make her leave. And it was just one of those moments where it was like this peace and calm and quiet amidst what is an emotionally fraught situation, both on a romantic level, but also on a survival level. Mm-hmm. And it was just this beautiful, quiet moment that I think is what they excel at the best when they throw this in there. And it was just this, oh, I need to keep going. And it was this wonderful exhale.
So
and that bit of level ended. You got a sense of like, there's another character they mentioned, Eugene, who works at, who was part of their encampment. And you get a sense of his relationship to the two of them and whatnot. And they stumble upon his secret weed den where he was growing a bunch of weed that has all now died.
Oh no.
It's all dead, but
the biggest tragedy in the Last of Us is weed.
Spoilers, you'll never believe who dies in The Last of Us Part 2, the weed.
The weed.
No!
The Last of Us Part 2. Sorry, it's early.
No, it works. So the two of them are down there.
So bad. Wow.
I loved it.
It's another 70s joke for you.
The two of them are down there. They find a couple joints. They're like, I don't know how old this is, but let's smoke it. And then they start talking about... Dina's like, so how would you rate our kiss? And it's just the two of them going
That's
back
what
and
I love
forth.
To ask.
Yeah, you always
What video game franchise would you never want to be stoned in?
Yep.
Check out my kiss on Yelp.
Okay. Well, it's the two of them being like, I don't know how to approach this situation, and you get that so quickly, and it goes into cutscene at this point, but the two of them are the animation on them is just amazing. Like the way their performances come through is just incredible. And it's the two of them going back and forth, trying to figure out where the other stands. And then finally they kiss again. And it's this like wonderful, heartwarming, like sweet moment of reprieve for them in the midst of all this, because earlier in the level, they get separated for a brief bit, in a blizzard that's kicking up. And you know, Ellie loses track of Dina, and you're just trying to, you're walking your horse through this area and you have no idea where to go because the trail is gone and it's kind of a circular area and you can't find her. And then eventually she pops up and it's like, I'm here. And they find each other and it's just this like, okay, there's nothing I could have done but look for her.
Can we speculate for 1 second? Because the story trailer quite heavily implied that Ellie was on a revenge mission.
Yeah.
Possibly to avenge Dina. Mm-hmm. That it's a strong implication. Now, for me, I don't think that Naughty Dog would reveal or even strongly hint at such a major plot point so early on. And I don't believe, with all of the focus they've put on Dina thus far, that they're just going to kill her off and that Ellie's going to go on a rampage. You spoke to Neil.
Yeah.
What did he have to say about that?
And like playing to your point, I do think it is misdirection because they're willing to reveal so little about this game. Mm. And then to reveal that when they've played up this relationship feels like it would be really bad pulling the rug from underneath us. Neil said that relationship is very important to Ellie and Ellie's journey, but wouldn't say more than that. Based on what I saw, based on what we've seen from the trailer and whatnot, I do think they hinted that. Obviously, I think Ellie believe she sees a tragedy or sees a tragedy that we don't know the specifics of. Mm-hmm. And I think we're all assuming it's one thing, but don't think it will be that.
Mm. Yeah. Cause we did essentially get that story already in Left Behind. You know, we know what it's like to see her. We know what it's like to see her lose her whole family. And we know what it's like to see her lose her love interest and what that does to her emotionally, mentally. So I do hope that this veers differently than that.
Knowing that they're making the sequel because they felt like they figured out the story that worked. Mm-hmm. Like they felt like this story needed to be told. It would be weird to be like, yeah, it's basically just telling the same emotional beat for this character we already told. That doesn't feel like a Naughty Dog story move. And I think they are great enough storytellers to know to avoid that.
I'm hoping there's a lot of misdirection here because I thought that the initial reveal was like, oh, this looks like dark and interesting and different and tonally like more grown up. Like it looked, there was something palpably sort of different, like time had passed. And then the trailer we saw just this last week felt kind of like more of the same. It was all prettier and bigger graphics and all the snow looked cool and there were horses and stuff. But it was at the same time, it looked much more like The Last of Us Part One. So I'm really hoping that there's some sleight of hand here.
I definitely think there is because talking to Neil about the scope of the game, he was like, you know, the reason the game is so big is because of all the twists and turns that we are putting into the story that necessitated it to be this big. And there are a lot of things that we just, have no idea of just yet. And he's like, this game has a large cast of characters. We've ostensibly met like 4 people in this world. We know right. Ellie, Joel, Dina, their friend at the dance, whose name I forget. And that's about it, named character-wise.
I'm so excited for how much this is going to subvert our expectations, because obviously the first one did that left and right, and that's why it's so highly regarded. I mean, the fact that it would just, you'd be in this like, oh, we're so conditioned to be like, oh, a video game doesn't take breaks story-wise. Like, it kind of is just one consistent adventure. Maybe there's a, passage of day or night or whatever, but for the most part, it doesn't just stop and be like, yeah, no, several months passed. You don't know how many. Figure it out,
Yeah.
So for it to do more of that is extremely exciting. I hope that there's some kind of like surprising time leap or some kind of, curveball thrown at us mid game.
I think
that's my favorite part of the last one. So
yeah, I believe that like Naughty Dog, and same with like Corey Barlog and his team at Sony Santa Monica, like they have the ability to weave some really delicate, nuanced storytelling in big shooty bang bang AAA space.
Yeah.
And I have like faith in that team more than anyone.
Me so,
to be able to tell something that is actually quite poignant and real.
Yeah, yeah. Based on what I saw, it very much was like, this feels like The Last of Us. Like, this feels like the game that I love. It's one of my favorite games of all time. That ending is my favorite ending to any game. It felt like that game, but evolved. Mm. But I also know that they're hiding so much that there's all that I'll write in my preview probably won't even scratch the surface of what this game holds. And that's really exciting to know because it's 5 months away. Like, this game is a reality now.
Speaking of which, I wanted to talk about the release date because I think it has bigger implications at large about what we've been theorizing about the rollout for PlayStation 5 and next gen in general.
I was completely wrong. I was thinking that it was going to be a PlayStation 5 like launch title along with a PlayStation 4.
One of those like those
bridge games.
Yeah, the Twilight Princess-y bridge games, right? We've been theorizing for a long time based on the rollout for the PS4 that we would get a reveal in February and a launch in fall for the PS5. I no longer feel that way at all because I feel like it would be kind of insane for PlayStation to essentially, you know, step on the rollout for The Last of Us and impede on that with PlayStation 5 news, unless there's a really dumb reason to do it, or B, a really smart reason to do it, in that there's some sort of like, if you buy The Last of Us on PS4, you unlock this on PS5 inevitably. And so I do think that we will get PlayStation 5 news now a little bit later, like March or April or something like that.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like they're going to fly a bunch of people to New York City to check out the PS5
a week before.
The week before The Last of Us 2 comes out. That's their flagship swan song until we hear about whatever's going on with Ghost of Tsushima.
Well, and that's the other big question mark. Obviously, The Last of Us is more of a name, but Ghost is still a highly anticipated game. I have a feeling it'll be like Last of Us, PS5, Ghost.
Yep.
PS5 reveal, Ghost. Yep. I have a feeling Ghost is like middle of the year, like May to June-ish, maybe. Just based on they still need to put out the PS5 in the fall, presumably. And I don't think they want those like swallowing up the air from each other. But I do think we're not going to get a PS5 reveal in February, as I've been just assuming.
Yep.
But
which is kind of crazy, kind of cool. I have no idea how Microsoft is going to handle their rollout next year. Next year is going to be very interesting because it's one of the most densely packed swan song years I've ever seen in the history.
It's a crazy year
of covering consoles.
Yeah.
And also, two brand new systems are coming out, and there are a bunch of things in the air in terms of massive first-party exclusives coming through Sony, one of which now has a release date, two of which have release dates, if you count Death Stranding, and also Ghost, which could be a PS5 launch game, but also the bridge thing we're talking about. So
I think that game will definitely still come to PS4. I don't think they would take it away after they've promised it for PS4.
Totally.
I think you run into a bad... I know some people theorize that about Last of Us Part 2, and I think you run into a really, really bad PR snafu that you don't have to when you're like, you just have to buy the new console, even though we told you you didn't have to.
It's also a massive, financial failure to rob the opportunity of tens of millions of existing PS4 owners to drop down 60 to 150, depending on what statues it comes with, dollars on a brand new game that they've been excited for a long time. Like, leaving that audience behind for a new audience, I imagine that you'll sell between, 5 and 10 million units before 2021 starts to kick in. Of the PlayStation 5, maybe more than that, maybe less, we'll see. But that's a fraction of what you can make off of selling an existing audience
to 100 million people.
Yeah. That said, we know about backwards compatibility being a thing in some way, and so I'm really interested to see how that's going to work. We've been talking about that for a long time on the show, of like, how do you get people to double dip on stuff like that? The Last of Us, the first game, getting ported to PS4 was a massive financial boon for them because you had a lot of people who were playing that for the very first time. And I imagine that's going to continue to happen. And so we'll see. I do think they'll find some way to incentivize people to not only buy that game on PS4, but also play it again on PS5, because there will be some sort of inherent, bonus of doing that, whether that's visually or there's content or something.
Yeah.
So that's going to be cool.
Yeah, and I'm curious to see what the life of Last of Us is post its release, especially with if they decide to do any DLC, what multiplayer there may be. That is a huge mystery as of right now, too.
Yeah, getting a sort of left behind story for this game 6 to 8 months later or something like that.
Yeah.
I still believe Left Behind was one of the best pieces of DLC all time.
Yeah.
Hands down.
Good.
I forget how long after the initial game's launch that was, but it felt just right to be like, let's go back in here for a couple more hours. It was the kind of thing you could finish in like an evening, which I really appreciated.
Yeah.
I think it took me like 2 or 3 hours.
Yeah. It's small, but like worthwhile in so many ways. Yeah.
I love that.
I play that. Like, that was one of those games that I would play in front of people to show how amazing games were.
Yeah.
Because you know what I mean? Like, I know that's stupid, but it's like, it was just the right size so they wouldn't get bored.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also just, it's so emotionally powerful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did PT in front of all my friends to scare them. I think that pretty much covers everything I saw. I think I forgot to mention Ellie has a dodge button now too. Did I mention that? We've had so many conversations on or off the show.
Yeah.
Anyway, Ellie has a dodge button now in combat, which makes it yet a little bit more complex. But on the combat side, same familiar arsenal of guns that she had. They can be upgraded with different components. You can add more capacity or less recoil, whatnot. But yeah, by and large, there were like a lot of really familiar aspects to how it played, but I didn't want it to, you know, throw out the rule book of what The Last of Us did. It felt like it was improving on some of the aspects that lacked on like a playability level while keeping the story and performance elements that worked so well.
I mean, which is great, because like as Max said earlier, The Last of Us is a last-gen game. You know, mm-hmm. that is a game from the PS3 era. And so I do like the idea of that being more intuitive and dynamic now. And
it's crazy that it was a last-gen game.
It's insane.
In my, I mean, I did play Remastered as well, but
of course,
like,
yeah.
In my mind, it's still so sort of like relevant, and it's still such a prestige game.
It's incredibly ahead of its time at the same time, you know.
So Max,
I mean, Naughty Dog's really good about, I think, sort of picking their battles and how they scale their stuff. You know, like they typically sort of keep one franchise per console generation. And then this sort of last couple of years, it's been interesting watching them deviate from that, where it was like, oh, the Uncharted trilogy's done. Okay, time for The Last of Us. And then a standalone story of The Last of Us. And then Uncharted 4, mm-hmm. a fourth game. That's always, and it was, you know, added some new mechanics, and it was, you know, there's a grappling hook, and it was like, oh, this is wider. There's a truck with a winch on it. And then now we're back to The Last of Us. So, you know, it's kind of...
I mean, they also did a six-hour Uncharted sequel.
Exactly, yeah.
Kind of snuck in there too, which is one of my favorites as well.
Yeah, and it'll be really cool to see. I mean, they kind of... It used to be like, oh, you know, three Crash Bandicoots and Jack and Dexter and then, you know, Uncharted. And it's like there's very, very... And their audience has grown up with them, which I think is always really cool. But also, like, they don't just do like, oh, time for another one. Let's throw out the formula and do something entirely new. Let's completely, you know... Just reinvent the wheel and build a better mousetrap or whatever. They're kind of like, no, let's take a close look at this and figure out what works. And I really, that's, I think what makes their game so good is that they're firmly grounded in a sort of proven foundation.
Yeah. And the sequel feels like it's built in what worked for the first game, but it's being created because they had the ideas and the desire to continue that world and to refine that world that they had made and expand upon it. And I think there is so much more to see. Like, I do genuinely believe in them in saying that what I played was such a small fraction of the game. I do think there's so much more that they are keeping away from us, knowing what they've kept in the past about the story of the first Last of Us and other games, that I can't wait to see more of it. It left me really, really itching to be like, okay, when can I just play the full thing? Yeah. And now we know.
Mm-hmm. Also, that's super cool that they've kept it this buttoned up until now. And that they're like, here's the end of the light is at the end of the tunnel. It is, here's the date.
Yeah.
Pre-order now and get a free banjo or whatever.
Backpack.
Mm-hmm. Backpack.
Yeah, so that was, it was a hell of a 2 hours to play, and I can't wait to see more. I'll have a full written preview on IGN. Lucy and I did a conversation about what I saw. We have some interview breakouts with Neil Druckmann on the site as well, so you can definitely check out all of that stuff. Before we wrap up, I did want to talk about Last of Us playing a big role in this other major Sony thing that happened this week, State of Play. So Sony aired the third State of Play while I was at the Last of Us Part 2 event. Thanks, Sony. Which ended with that Last of Us release date trailer, but it also included, as we mentioned before, the PS Plus games for October being Last of Us Remastered and MLB 2019. Pretty great month, as well as a look at some upcoming PSVR titles, the announcement of Humanity from the Tetris Effect developers, which they kind of left ambiguous what the game will actually play like, but we got a sense of it.
Wasn't that announced?
Right. Oh, it was announced already. This was just a new trailer highlighting it. Thank you.
Very cool.
Yeah, I liked that trailer a lot.
I totally forgot about that game, and the trailer started, and I was like, oh, Tetris Effect 2.
Yep.
And then it said Humanity, and I was like, I don't get it. Brian was like, they already announced that. And I was like, oh, sorry.
Yeah.
I like how it kind of initially looked like really like fun. Like it sort of reminded me of like a Nintendo trailer for a second. It was like, oh, this is, you know, adorable. You're controlling all these little people. And then they just start shooting at each other.
And then getting pushed off a ledge. It's like, oh, this is a physics simulator. Good.
Yeah. I'm very interested.
Mess them up.
Because I read on their blog that, you know, there's a message, there's a sort of deeper message behind it, and I'm really intrigued.
Yeah. I, especially after Tetris Effect, I trust that team implicitly, so I'm excited to see what they do next.
It looks like a really high tech puzzle game.
Yeah,
That's the kind of thing you couldn't really. I mean, it looks, people comparing it to Lemmings kind of, but it's kind of cool to see what's clearly a puzzle or rhythm type game with that many moving parts, because usually that's a fairly rudimentary genre. With usually some sort of bells and whistles thrown on it.
They know how to put a twist on a like familiar formula, so I'm excited to see what they do there. We also learned Wadham, the new game from the Katamari Damacy creator, is coming in December.
It was announced in like 2012
or
something.
Yeah, it's been around for forever.
Yeah, I think it was 2015, and suddenly it's like, oh, it's coming out in December.
That was there. Arise was announced from Techland Publishing. It is seems like a very emotional
studio.
Personal,
is like Piccolo? I don't
know.
So again, this is a studio led by three people who were in advertising, and they got so bummed out by like the ruthless world of advertising that they formed this video game studio. This is their first game.
Oh wow. Okay.
And it looks very pretty. It looks like it has the potential to be very moving.
Yes.
Because you play like you're dead, and then you revisit like the highs and lows of your life.
Yeah, it's a really interesting concept, and I'm excited to see what more comes from
that. Like a cute God of War.
Mm-hmm. I'll take that.
I'm glad they came over to the gaming side, where there's never any arguments. Everyone agrees.
Yeah, I'm sure their first game will launch without a hitch, and everyone will be very nice about it, and forgiving, and it'd be just really, they'll be so sweet.
Be crawling back to advertising.
Let us sell sports drinks for the love of God.
That was in their new Call of Duty cinematic trailer for the campaign, which looked like they just filmed live action half the time.
That dude's beard is constantly taking me out of that whatever that story is. I don't care about Call of Duty. I haven't played one of those campaigns in like 7 years. I am completely agnostic to the entire like controversy around whatever this is, or non-controversy, whatever it is. But that dude's beard, it makes him look like he's like an old timey like Barnum and Bailey.
He looks like that dude from Animal House.
Yeah, he looks like a circus man from the 1920s. He looks like he should be on the Animal Crackers box wrangling cartoon tigers.
I mean, from the first Modern Warfare, Price was like two steps removed from that. He's right? Basically that guy, but he's in the military.
Exactly. Yeah. He looks like he'd die of scurvy on a boat. Like, he doesn't look like he belongs in like a game with the word modern written so many times in the marketing.
Let's get Infinity Ward to change it.
That's my
change. Change the beard.
Yeah, I don't change care about the white beard. Phosphorus or whatever, but they shave that man's face.
That's the post credit scene. It's him just
take Barnum and Bailey out of the gun game. I don't want him in there.
Max and I were walking down the street in San Francisco once, and we saw a guy with a cartoon mustache on like one of those like 8 foot tall bicycles. And both of us were at the same exact time. We're like, "Oh, f you."
You ever want to like hear what disapproval sounds like silently?
Yeah,
it's just the air between us whenever somebody with like a handlebar mustache shows up. Yeah, we're both just like.
they're usually on like in some sort of cartoon vehicle that they disallowed in the 1930s.
Well, no, they put carrying all their skill points in a mustache, and they're wearing like Dockers and like a pair of like Tevas, and you're like, you ever think about, you know, maybe character designing the rest of your character there, Chief?
Yeah, exactly. That has to appear in cutscenes that we all have to watch.
Yeah, finish your Xbox avatar.
Say hi to your mother for me.
Sorry. Sorry, go back to talk about games.
Following Handlebar Mustache Simulator was also PSVR. Look ahead at that stuff. Not anything that we didn't really know about. There was one or two, I think, games announced in there, but they were very much in a like
Space Channel
quick
5.
Hurried way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do we not know about that?
I don't know.
Yeah.
And then L.A. Noir.
L.A. Noir was now between this and Nintendo Switch. It's when Rockstar is like, let's test this thing out for a few months.
Yeah.
They're such a weird company.
Yeah.
That's been on a couple other VR headsets. It's now available on PSVR. But that was pretty much like the meat and potatoes of that whole thing. A medieval demo is now available.
I think you're forgetting something very special. The most special thing.
Oh yeah. The Death Stranding PS4 Pro Special Edition. Thank you.
Yeah.
My
kid has hand-painted all of those, by the way. So
yeah, has the handprints on the face of the console. But more importantly,
Has your kid ever pissed a whole DualShock 4 controller?
It has a translucent yellow DualShock.
Yeah, that's definitely pee yellow.
I like with how the baby in there.
It's pee.
Well, no, apparently the baby's not in there.
Oh, it's
the
just baby, like painted on?
Those are the things that make the RumbleShock working. That's how they get the DualShock.
Because, like, I thought for a second, I don't know.
Put a baby in the controller.
I was writing a wrap-up of this whole thing. And for a second, like, an image was on my screen of the baby in the controller. I was like, I'm getting this weird piece of shit, like, console right now because the baby's in there. And that's just wild to me.
If they just sold the controllers by themselves, I'd totally jump on it. Be like, oh, no, my controller's done. Honey, hand me that piss-colored one over there, over yonder. I don't know why I talk like that.
With a baby in it.
Yeah. I cracked up because they totally were like, yeah, that's great. Death Stranding coming soon. I was like, oh, it's going to be a new trailer? And I was like, nope, it's baby's first console.
Yeah, that was not the way I thought they'd show Death Stranding in this state of play, but there you go if you need a new PS4 Pro. Yeah, that on the whole was the highs, maybe some of the lows of that state of play. Briefly before we wrap up, because I think we're running out of time in here, what did you all think of this third state of play?
I mean, it's one of those things where it's like The Last of Us did so much heavy lifting that the rest of it just sort of felt superfluous. I actually like found the tone of the entire thing very bizarre, because they, like, we came out after this like heart-wrenching guttural revenge flick in terms of The Last of Us, and then you hear the narrator and they're like, and that's The Last of Us Part 2.
And you won't have to wait long to stab a man directly in the jugular. The Last of Us is coming to PlayStation 4 console.
Shiv your February friends 21st. Or a dog on February 21st, 2021, or 2020, whatever. You know what I'm saying.
It's 2021.
I thought it was like, yeah, it was weird because obviously there was so much hype generated by like all the teasers that had come out of Naughty Dog. And everyone was just waiting to see The Last of Us, and they were dropping some pretty dry announcements, like, especially in the sort of second half. And I was just like, oh, come on, guys, like, get on with it. Like, we don't really, do we really need to see this right now?
Yeah, it felt like there could have been a better balance between, like, the bigger stuff and the smaller stuff. Like, the fact that it opened, you know, the first 15 minutes of it outside of Call of Duty, everything was relatively smaller scale. Felt very odd.
Yeah.
Especially,
no, it's like Weird Al opening up for Slayer. Like, it doesn't make any sense. Like, they show the Katamari Damacy guy's new game, and he's like, oh, look at these funny shapes with lips.
I just,
I'm going to kill everyone that touches my girlfriend.
I think that with State of Play, they should maybe, like, theme them a bit better.
Yeah.
Like if they're going to do one that just focuses on small indie games, then have that as, like, a this is the indie game State of Play. If they're going to have one that focuses on The Last of Us, then just make it The Last of Us.
Yeah. If this was just a 10 minutes of The Last of Us and it was the trailer, they show you the collector's edition, they tell you a few basic facts about the
game.
They
could have padded out the collector's edition stuff, like, if they wanted to.
I think that would have worked better as a bit of marketing for this. And also, WB Games Montreal, don't tease a new Batman game in the 2 days before a state of play and an inside Xbox. Please, I want that game so badly. Yeah. Don't do that to us.
Yeah, we went through Batman Day and the state of play with no new news on the Batman game.
Yeah,
we'll leak the second we walk
the logo teases, but it was just like, I wish that had happened. But yeah, state of play, I think they're getting there. Like, second and third were definitely improvements on the first, but I think they're still getting the hang of how this thing works.
You think we're gonna see Batman at New York Comic Con?
It's not a bad idea.
Yeah, Batman is in the comic books.
He's been in one or two. Yeah. Other than that or the Game Awards, I think is probably where we'll see it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think state of play still has some work to do, but you know, having it end on The Last of Us trailer is not a bad way to go out. That, I think, pretty much wraps up the show. Again, I mentioned all of my Last of Us Part 2 coverage is on IGN.com right now. Some stuff on YouTube.com/IGN, so please go check all of that out. I hope you enjoy it. Other than that, we are usually airing the show every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Pacific. You can find it at beyond.ign.com, YouTube.com/IGN Beyond, and your favorite podcast services around the world. If you are listening on any of those services or on YouTube, please subscribe, please rate us, please tell us we did a good job. We always love that. But thank you to everyone who continues to write in, either to beyond@ign.com with questions or memory card stories or in the comments. We'll read plenty of those on the shows to come. Other than that, you can find us on Twitter and Instagram. Brian, where are you?
I'm at Agent Bizzle, and on Instagram I'm at Brian Altano.
Lucy?
I'm at Luce O'Brien on Instagram and Twitter.
Max?
Find me on Twitter at Totino's Official on Instagram at Planters Peanuts.
Perfect. And I am at JM Dornbush on Twitter and Instagram. Those are my real accounts. You can find us there when we're not here. Thank you so much for listening and watching as always. Beyond.
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 Hey there, this is Justin Bartha. I made a funny new podcast, King of the Egg Cream. It has the greatest cast in the history of podcasts with actors like Louis Black.
I'm torn by my feelings for two women.
Bobby Cannavale.
You can eat it, or if someone hits you, you can put it on your cut.
Melanie Lynskey.
I wonder what these marvelous things are that look just like boiled chicken feet.
Jason Ritter.
I can break things and pick locks and kill people.
Michael Stuhlbarg.
The whole point is to inspire people that they should make themselves better.
Ari Grainer.
No, don't whet its appetite. What are you, an idiot?
Me, Justin Bartha.
That's not just any egg cream, that's a Lemke's special.
And all narrated by the hilarious Richard Kind.
This is the story of Harry Dalowitz and how he rose from nothing to become New York's King of the Egg Cream.
So if you like funny true stories, come listen to King of the Egg Cream, available wherever you get your podcasts.